to the 8th episode of Season 4 of the Ubuntu UK podcast. It's Tuesday the 7th of June 2011, and in this episode we are going to talk about how we should administer our Ubuntu servers and talk to Frank Karliczek about OwnCloud. We will of course cover the latest news, events, bit about Ubuntu, command line love, and go over your feedback. I'm Mark, and with me this week are Tony.
Hello, Mark.
How are you, Tony? What have you been doing this last fortnight?
I'm all right, and I've been doing lots of things. One of the most exciting things was I was the photographer at a wedding.
Ooh,
the official photographer.
Always the photographer, never the bride.
Never the bride. I have never yet been a bride. So I had to shoot with a friend of mine the whole day, starting at 8:30 in the morning, and we kept going till about 9:30, 10:00 in the evening, and we shot lots of images, which I'm now having to go through and post process. But it was fun. It was really enjoyable.
Brilliant.
And some nice photos.
What photo software are you using?
On Linux, I'm using the GIMP and Bibble.
Oh yes, you mentioned that a little while ago.
So the one for managing raw.
Yeah, raw files and processing and stuff, and GIMP for anything more than that, really.
But, yeah, Alan. What have you been up to?
I took my computer apart, my desktop PC apart the other day, and got rid of all the dust that was inside it. And man alive, there's a lot of dust. Real pretty horrible. Because it's on the floor underneath my desk.
Yeah.
And it's kind of just sat underneath in there. And I also replaced two of the hard drives with SSDs.
Ooh,
so nice. To make it a bit faster and quieter. And
is it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Yeah, it's quick.
Because lots of people say you put an SSD in and it boots in 10 seconds and all that
stuff. It is quick at booting. I originally had it dual booting XP for games and stuff and Ubuntu on two separate hard disks. Now I went out and actually bought a copy of Windows 7, which was painful. But it's only for games, so that's okay.
That's what Richard Stallman says.
Yes, exactly. It's for evaluating games. So games on one and Ubuntu on the other. Yeah, it's good. It's quick. That wasn't really the target. The target was make it quieter and less hot in there.
Cool.
So,
cool.
Yes.
Laura, what have you been up to?
Madly pimping my survey that I pimped on the last show.
And did your pimping suffice?
I got a huge number of people, so thank you very much to everybody who did
it. When was the deadline?
It is this Friday morning, this coming Friday.
Oh, okay, so they can still do it?
They can still do it. In particular, if you know somebody who's, or you are, not techie or geeky, and not specifically into the environment or energy, I'd love to get your views as well, because I want to try and get as balanced a range of people as possible. Obviously, all my friends are quite techie, geeky, or into energy.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So if you know someone who leaves light bulbs on all over the place, they'd be a good person to pass it on to.
Or just don't care, but care enough to fill in the survey.
So how long does the survey take?
It's about 20 minutes.
Okay, so get a cup of tea. And
And what's the link?
It's is.gd/UK/energy survey. We'll stick it in the show notes.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Cool. And what about you, Mark?
I have been purchasing a ProLiant microserver.
Ooh.
Oh,
welcome to the club.
Off the back of a lorry, aren't they?
What's that?
it's like a mini little 8p server, which is very cheap and can fit lots of hard drives in it.
8p?
HP.
HP. Not that is cheap.
Though.
Okay. Yeah, I've got one as well. Yeah.
Sorry?
What are you doing with it?
Oh, basically, I had my home network storage solution was a USB hard drive in an enclosure plugged into a Guru plug server, and the hard drive died and I lost everything I had on it.
Ow.
So I thought,
what's your job?
I don't have to manage the
backups.
Yeah, I'm a web developer. I'm not a backup manager. So basically I thought I should have something which I can put a RAID array in, but I didn't want to spend a lot of money. And it was the perfect solution as soon as I actually get the RAID array working.
They're quite diddy, aren't they?
Yes.
Physically very small.
Yeah, they are. They're like sort of half the length of a sort of normal tower case and sort of... Well,
it's about the size of a shuttle PC.
Yeah, like a short shuttle PC.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Excellent. Well, that's covered what we've all been doing, so I suppose we should get on with it.
we had some feedback from listener Jason Simmons, and it got us thinking that we could have a little chat about this. And it was relating to Linux server admin, also relating to Mark's recent acquisition.
Oh, yeah.
And how, well, server admin on Linux is comprehensive, and there's tools for just about everything. But one thing we seem to be lacking is a kind of front end to all of it. When you look at something like an installation of a Windows server, you get a nice pretty GUI and nice ways to visualize what's going on and easy fields to fill in with online help and all that kind of stuff. Whereas often with Linux servers, you have a text file you edit. And should that change? Should we be making servers easy to administer?
Yeah, Jason was sort of getting after the fact that Linux does feel like it's a long way behind the ease of use of these Windows equivalents, really. And he's got a point. Certainly you can't just sit somebody in front of a Linux server at a flashing cursor on a command line and say, right, you know, create some users or you know, set up a web server or whatever, unless they happen to be a Linux administrator.
Yeah. So
what tools do you have at the moment? And who here is an admin of servers?
I'm an admin to an extent.
Yeah, I am, yeah.
Yeah, I do. I use Linux boxes at work, and I have a server at home and a VPS and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I guess I'm kind of like not a professional sysadmin, so yeah.
Yeah, I did it once on a course. Yeah. Very well, but I did it.
It's not really part of a big part of my job anymore, but it certainly has been in the past, doing a lot of Linux system administration.
So who would be the target for this kind of thing? Who's going to administer a Linux server? I mean, your average, you know, geek kind of picks this stuff up.
Well, I mean, there are people who run Windows at home as a server, either a Windows version of server or just a Windows desktop that they've set up with, you know, IIS or whatever on it to run as a home server. And those people don't feel very well catered for, particularly. I sort of see that if you're a hardcore Linux system administrator, you're going to use the command line, you're going to edit the config files, you're going to have the patience to track down the syntax error you made where you missed a semicolon off the end of one line and then the whole thing broke.
But then again, if you're the kind of person who runs a server at home, aren't you probably that kind of person anyway?
I don't know. I think there's a fair number of people now that computers are multiple generations old now, people have older kit. And they don't necessarily want to throw it away, and they want to do something. They think, oh, I could probably do something with that. And that thing that they do with it could be like just a file server. It could be like you've done, like a central storage server, or it could be maybe they want to stream music around their house.
Yeah, but again, would they do it themselves? Yeah, would they set that up themselves? Would they not just buy a plug-in NAS box?
Well, that's what I'm saying. If they already had the box, if they've
retired
generations. So, for example, there's a guy at work who has a box that he stores all his files on and his kids store their files on. But he went for a packaged box, like you say, a NAS, like a Buffalo a NAS station or something like that. And if you look at those, they all have web admin tools. None of them get you to Telnet in to set up the file shares or anything.
Yeah.
These appliances all have web admin tools. Now, I realize Linux isn't an appliance, but some of the features could certainly be seen as an appliance, like...
That's kind of the thing I was thinking of, the classic thing is people who have no geeks in their household and they want to set up a wireless access point. And that used to be a real nightmare, and I think it's probably a bit better now, but you had to understand all the technical concepts in order to be able to do it. And it's probably the same if you want something like a file storage system. So many people have got photographs now that they want to back up. And it's... you don't want to have to get your local geek in or anything. You just want to be able to buy it in a box, take it home, plug it into the wall, and it pretty much works.
And that's exactly what, you know, someone walking around a store like Best Buy or PC World, they buy a box that says your perfect one-stop backup solution, and it is effectively that. You plug it in the network, you point a browser at it, you say, back up my stuff, job done. Whereas you get geeks who put a PC in a cupboard somewhere and then set up all these weird commands and crons and tar and all this kind of stuff.
To the make cupboard it all... gets really, really warm.
Yeah, and then a disc fails and they lose it all. So are normal people really going to do this?
Well, it sounds a lot like we're saying that all of these things that you buy all have a nice web interface.
Yeah.
Well, can't you just install Webmin on Linux?
Webmin has been around for a long time, isn't it?
So surely it's got everything you could need and works really well.
It depends what your needs are. If your needs are a graphical way of administering the Samba shares,
yeah,
or a graphical way of administering the raid arrays or whatever it is that's inside the thing,
mm-hmm,
yes, it has that. Does it have an easy to use method that's comparable with the boxes you get from PC World and Best Buy? I don't think so, no.
Right.
You still need to know a bit.
Yeah, it's a pretty old school web interface as well, isn't it?
No,
yeah,
it's been updated. It's not that bad. Yeah.
Okay.
It's more recently, it's certainly, like, I surprised myself. I installed it on my HP microserver to have a play with it because I thought, well, let's try this out because I can administer the system via the command line, but actually sometimes I'd quite like to have a browser interface. And yeah, it's not bad. It looks okay. But it's not good enough for end users, I don't think.
See, I think it depends on how you're breaking up your users, because when we were talking about a minute ago, we were talking about proper home, just consumer,
yeah,
mainstream consumers, and they probably wouldn't matter to them because they get an appliance out of the box and it just plug in. So this is probably more at home where you've got somebody, like say if I were doing it, I wouldn't be doing it day to day, so I wouldn't learn all the commands and instinctively have them at the tips of my fingers.
Yeah.
I'd probably know what I was trying to do, but I just want a quick and easy way to do it. And I mean, yeah, I find this administering my Linux desktop. I constantly, you know, if the network manager doesn't work, it crashed the other day or something, and I couldn't remember how to restart it because it's such a long time since I've done the ETH up and down. And that was really, really frustrating. So just if in that sort of situation in a web server or whatever, it'd be really good just to have an easy UI.
And I have exactly the same problem when I'm using editing config files. For example, I do all my backups with a tool called rsnapshot. Mm-hmm. And rsnapshot has a bizarre configuration file format.
Oh, it does, doesn't it? You have to put tabs in certain places.
Yeah, you have to have tab separation.
Yeah.
You can't put a space, and you have to use tabs. So if you try and line it up with four spaces, or your text editor that you're using puts four spaces instead of a tab, it screws the file up. So, you know, and I forget that. I know that. I know that this is the case, and I've known this for years.
Yeah.
But I forget that when I go to edit my rsnapshot file and I walk away having added a new system in and I come back and it's broken and it hasn't backed up for 3 days as a result. And that's just not acceptable. But I mean, that's my own stupidity for not remembering it. But why should I have to balance all this useless information inside my head when I really want to point at a web browser and go back up that box and not have to worry about the underlying stuff that happens?
Well, the comparison with the desktop that Laura's making is quite a good one, I think, because I had to create a user on one of my netbooks for Mark the other week, and I was able to do that really easily through a little GUI tool and click add a user and give it the details and set a password, or it'll generate one for you, or require to change it on login, all sort of stuff, and job done. But and that was a very simple process, but it was for one user.
Yeah.
Now, if you were managing a network of 10,000 people or something, you don't want to have to do that. Now, sure, you can script or shell script or Perl script or whatever to make some fancy LDAP command that will create all this for you, and there's probably people who have already done those scripts. But, you know, is there a really good equivalent to, say, you know, the Active Directory users and computers tool that there is on Windows networks?
Mm-hmm.
Is it that easy just to sit down and click a GUI tool to manage a larger network on Linux and on Ubuntu? And I don't think it is yet, because the server, Ubuntu server, is still entirely command line based.
Yeah, I mean there are companies out there who have front ends for this kind of stuff. So, for example, there's a group called Turnkey Linux, and they create appliances, and I think they put Webmin on theirs. So out of the box, you get a virtual machine that has, you know, a DNS server and a web server on it, or whatever like appliance you've chosen. And to administer it, you just point your browser at it, and it's all made much simpler. And they have bazillions of these appliances with all kinds of applications in it. And then there's a company called Zential, which I believe the product used to be called Ebox, which is very similar to Webmin, but prettier and nicer and, you know, a bit easier to use. And they do the same things. These are all third-party companies who do these value-add things. Why don't we have this built in?
But it clearly can be done. I mean, that's one of the things people used to say at Webmin, is that you had to run it as root, and therefore it's a security concern and stuff. But if these other companies are able to develop solutions which work reasonably well, and Webmin is able to be brought up to date and works reasonably well, yeah, there obviously isn't a hugely good, as long as you don't make that accessible to the world via or unprotected password or something, then you're obviously doing reasonably well.
Yeah.
So is that something that should be sort of a program which is running on the Ubuntu server, or should that be a sort of value-added service from Canonical or another company? Something like they provide, is it called Landscape for managing and keeping eye, monitoring your servers? Is that,
well, that,
for the moment?
That does some of this. I mean, Landscape will let you do remote updates, for example.
Yeah.
So rather than me having to SSH into my server and do apt-get update, apt-get dist upgrade, I can just go to a web page and press a button, and it will go off and do the updates at some time and let me know when they're done. Or I can tell it I need a particular package installed, but it doesn't do the fine-grained admin of the applications themselves.
Right.
It's more of a low-level, you know, keep the box going kind of thing, yeah, rather than a individual application front-end.
It monitors disk space and things.
Yeah, it has some monitoring in there, so you can see it'll produce graphs like the old MRTG time, yeah, graphs of CPU, memory, disk, and that kind of stuff. But Landscape is a paid-for service,
yeah,
rather than a built-in. Yeah, the cynical person might say maybe that's why Canonical haven't put any effort into developing a tool that's built into Ubuntu server, because then it would detract from their paid-for service.
Yeah, true.
One thing I was wondering is, I mean, when you talk about making things easy to use, you get people complaining about dumbing down and things, mm-hmm, and sort of requiring fewer skills or less specialist skills. I was thinking, in, say, an environment where you want people to, as an example, add lots of users every term at a college or a school or whatever, mm-hmm, is it not better to have somebody in the team who understands a bit about user admin, that kind of thing, but they can create the users quite easily on a Windows system or on a Linux system without having to have deep, say, Linux technical understanding, which is often rarer than Windows understanding anyway? Isn't that more useful to you for them to be able to do that quite easily than, you know, sort of saying, oh no, you've got to be able to understand the underlying operating system?
It's tricky because, you know, the people who say we shouldn't dumb this down are the people who are often those who are skilled in this area, mm, and the more you dumb it down and make it easier for other people to use, the less work there is
for them.
Well, the harder it is for them if you put a front end on it, but equally the other option is it might mean there's less work for them.
That's true. Yeah, less specialized skill requirement.
Mm. Exactly.
I think there always is a need for that specialized requirement, though, because there are so many times where I've tried to start explaining something the easy way to somebody, and about halfway through I find myself going, find myself thinking that, oh, hang on, from the command line you do it this way or that way, and you know how to do it on the command line, or you, yeah, know which config file it is to edit, but actually you're trying to explain to them some graphical tool to do it, and you just think, at what point should I give up and start to tell, yeah, them about the command,
I
mean, line?
I got panned on a lug mailing list once because someone asked a question and I gave them the run this sudo blah, and yes, that's the answer to your question. That will do what you want to do. And someone said, "Why? What? I'm interested. You like Ubuntu. Why aren't you telling them the easy way? You know, the go to system administration preferences, yeah, click this, flick that button." And because it just takes too long, is the answer. Yeah. It's easy. It's quick and easy. But if you're sat in front of it and you're self learning, or you know, it's much easier than like poke about in a user interface, isn't it?
Mm.
In a safe one.
But isn't some of it have the skills are in the understanding how to organize users, or, you know, organize what it is that you're trying to do, rather than understanding the details of the operating system?
Well,
and that's a skill in itself.
Yeah, it is. But you shouldn't let the fact that you have to type man user add and man group add as to be the thing that gets in the way of you creating 20 users at the beginning of term.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the other things is that isn't it all in the cloud now, anyway?
Well, yeah.
Should we really be doing all this ourselves?
Well, arguably, yeah. Apparently, most people now use Gmail for their email or other cloud services, and they use Dropbox to store their data. So why would you have
web-based front ends, essentially, don't they?
Yeah, they all are. Yeah, so why would you have a server at home?
I think, for home users, definitely. But, I mean, for instance, I work in a college, and the idea of putting all of our students' data in the cloud with a company has massive data protection alarm bells ringing.
Yeah.
So we do still need to have servers and databases internally, which we need to set up and administer ourselves.
Mm. Sure. And the same goes for the company I work at.
Yeah.
You know, there's no way they store all their data in a cloud. They have a massive data center with hundreds of servers in, and you know, it's bonkers the amount of hardware they have. But these are all like 200 Linux boxes that we all administer by SSHing in and typing commands. Although some of the admins would rather we had the GNOME desktop, but that's as it is.
Well, let us know what you think, whether we should be trying to establish or find really good graphical tools on the server to allow people to administer it, or whether we should make everybody look at Bash and learn Perl and Python and tab completion and stuff. And send your feedback to podcast@ubuntu-uk.org.
Time for some news. Linux founder and benevolent dictator Linus Torvalds has announced that the 2.6 series of kernel versions is to end and the next stable release will be version 3.0. The announcement comes as Linux approaches its 20th anniversary.
Wow.
Scary, isn't it?
Happy birthday, Linux.
It's like practically older than me, that. Wow.
20 years ago. What year is that?
1991.
Wow. I remember the first guy who thrust Linux floppy disks into my hand, and I remember saying to him, that'll never go anywhere.
It's quite interesting, the 3.0 version is not going to have much new in it at all. No. It's literally just a number change to celebrate the birthday, really. Yeah.
As they do time-based releases anyway, why not do a big one for a big time?
Yeah, that's fair enough.
Yeah, cool.
The Linux-based Xen virtualization technology will be fully supported in the next version of the kernel. This allows Linux to support Xen as a hypervisor and to run as a guest under Xen without the need for additional software.
Hurrah!
Yeah, except I'm a bit annoyed.
Why?
For 2 years we spent installing Xen, and then 2 years everybody was saying don't install Xen because it's not being maintained, and now, oh, apparently it is being maintained again.
Well, that's good, isn't it?
Yes.
In the long run, it's good that Xen is finally in the kernel, because you're right. We had Xen, and then everyone said, well, maybe you should be using KVM, because that's the blessed one that's in the kernel.
Yes.
And it's maintained.
Yes. And now Xen is in the kernel.
Does that matter, that Xen is now in the kernel, if everyone's now using KVM?
It's helped for people who stayed with Xen,
okay,
and presumably can now upgrade and have a bit of a better development cycle and stuff in the future, which is good. It is a good thing. It's just a shame that they let it all go off the boil when Citrix brought it, really.
Yes.
It went off the boil, and now it's back on the boil.
That's good.
Yay!
Glass half full.
That's the technical
You sourpuss. Here's a positive story for you, Tony.
Yay.
Hardware manufacturer Asus, who launched netbooks into the mainstream with their EPC range, have announced that a line of their miniature laptops will sell with Ubuntu pre-installed. This comes after Asus abandoned its Zandros-based Linux offerings in favour of Windows XP and Windows 7.
Yeah, but aren't netbooks dead?
Apparently so.
Mark holds netbook in the air proudly.
Yeah.
And points at Tony's on the desk.
Yeah. But, you know, new netbooks. Everybody's buying tablets, aren't they, these days?
I don't know, are they?
Are they?
I don't have either.
I bought a few of the old EPCs, the 701.
Literally a few.
Yeah. And they
one's never enough.
They were great. They really were. I really like that Zandros user interface.
All I'm saying is nobody is selling their kidney for a netbook.
Fair point.
Yeah. No, it's good news that we have more boxes with Ubuntu on.
As long as they don't keep on doing the whole "it's better with Windows" thing on their website, that will annoy me quite spectacularly.
Okay.
I've not quite figured out where you're going to be able to buy them yet either. Whether you get them in like normal shops like Amazon and PC World, or because the original ones you could buy in Toys R Us, which I thought was very bizarre, seeing a Linux machine running in Toys R Us.
Yeah, well, we'll keep an eye on their website, I guess. Oracle have donated the OpenOffice codebase to the Apache Software Foundation's incubator. This move has annoyed some of the supporters of LibreOffice, the Document Foundation's recent fork of the project, due to differing licenses now used for the two projects.
It hasn't actually finished, has it? They haven't actually signed it over yet, have they?
They have signed it over.
Right.
So the Apache Software Foundation now they now have a license for all the code and can release it under the Apache license, but they haven't voted whether to take it on as an Apache project or not.
Okay.
It's still a proposal.
What's that mean?
basically, if they vote to take it on as an Apache project, it goes into the Apache incubator, where it stays until it's got a sufficient community around it to be a viable, self-sustaining project.
So,
and that also means that all of the legal issues regarding any possible patents or trademark issues around the name of the project have been resolved.
Okay, so have Oracle done this deliberately to use an incompatible license with LibreOffice just to annoy people?
What's LibreOffice use?
LibreOffice is GPL, isn't it? Or LGPL.
Yeah.
Whereas, the Apache OpenOffice, as it will be under the Apache license, which means that code from the LibreOffice codebase can't be contributed directly to the OpenOffice codebase. But it can go the other way around. Of the way the Apache license works, you can take it and do anything. So you can take it and make it closed source if you want, which also means LibreOffice will be able to take the code.
But not back again.
Yeah, but they won't be able to contribute it back.
So me and Mark had this fascinating discussion about licenses earlier, and Poppy nearly fell asleep. We thought it was interesting.
Now who's it is interesting, but, for those of us who are not licensed nerds,
yes.
We just want them to figure it all out so that we could get a decent Office product and start knowing which one to back. So that, do we back OpenOffice or do we back LibreOffice? Seems that Michael Meeks is doing a lot of good work with trimming down LibreOffice.
But,
there's the possibility that that code can be contributed back or can't be contributed back, and then we end up with two completely divergent projects and users just have no idea what to do.
It's certainly happened over the last few months, and give it another 12 months, it may well have sorted itself out, resolved it. One project will probably have folded and gone away.
The thing is, even if it does get accepted into the incubator, if there's not a community around it, it'll never get out, so it'll never become a fully fledged project, necessarily.
Okay. It's like a nest.
So it could go into the incubator, and if the only community contributor to it is, for example, at a guess, IBM, they could use it in Lotus Symphony, for example.
Yes.
And they could be the only person who releases OpenOffice as Lotus Symphony.
Yes.
And everyone else uses LibreOffice. Yes.
The code will still be available from Apache as an incubated project, I believe.
And it doesn't matter, as long as the file formats are compatible,
people
can use whatever they like.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the end of the news. And we're going straight on to the events. There's just one event in our list this time to talk about, as I wave frantically at Alan to stop him pressing the wrong button. And that event is, of course, the one and the only
OCCamp.
Yay, well done. Yay. Didn't even rehearse that.
How long is it now until OCCamp?
It's about two months and a week.
Ouch.
So
that's
nine weeks.
Time.
Yeah. Gosh. How much is there left to do?
Lots.
Excellent. So OCCamp is our conference that we have. We're having it this year in Farnham in Surrey on the 13th.
Third one.
Yes, we've been doing it for 3 years now, and doesn't it feel like it? 13th and 14th of August this summer. And it's an unconference, which means that you kind of bring along your own content and your own things to do.
Yeah, we worked really hard organising it, honest.
I'm just glad we don't have to organise a full speakership, because that would be extra work. But yes, we're having one program track this year. Mark's going to tell us a little bit about that in a minute. But the rest of it is up to you. So you come along, and if you want to talk about something, give a talk about a project or just some thoughts. Alan gave a talk about the computer he set up for his mum and how he customised it last year. And that was very interesting. And lots of people refer to it now as Mumbuntu.
Yep. I might do an update to that, actually, and show what she's doing with it. What she's doing with it now. Got a couple of other talks lined up as well.
Yep.
Which is good fun.
But we are having a scheduled speaker track on the main stage, and Mark's been sorting that out.
Yes.
Give us some news.
We currently have two confirmed speakers. The first of which is Steve Lee from OSWatch and Full Measure, who's going to do a talk about accessibility in open source. So about making it accessible for people with disabilities or certain requirements using their computer, and how that is fitted in with open source projects.
Cool.
And we're also going to have a talk from Lorna Jane Mitchell, who's going to do.
Yeah.
She's talked at OCCamp.
I think
she's talked at both
OCCamps
and been very well received.
She's very good, very engaging speaker.
And she's going to be doing a talk about, I believe, how you can use your community involvement in open source to further your career.
Cool. That sounds good. Everybody's here.
We also have we've got some others lined up, but I'm not going to divulge any details until we know for sure that they're going to be there. I don't want to disappoint anyone.
Absolutely. So you can find out more at ogcamp.org, and if you'd like to come along, it's free entrance. We don't charge you to get in. All we do is ask you to sign up for a ticket at ogcamp11.eventbrite.com, and that just reserves you a place and make sure you can get in on the day. And come along, prepare to take part. Anything weird, wonderful, wacky, and a bit off the wall, be prepared to contribute. It's fun. It's time to chill out and meet like-minded people.
Buy some raffle tickets
probably.
Maybe.
And we're all going to be there, and we're going to do a live recording with the Linux Outlaws guys.
Yeah.
The event is very kindly sponsored by Chris Proctor on behalf of lug.org.uk, and we hope to have some other sponsors to announce very soon, because they make it happen, because they pay the money. But yeah, keep listening to us and keep listening to Linux Outlaws for more information.
Now we're interviewing Frank Karlicek from the OwnCloud project. Hi, Frank.
Hi.
So thanks for coming on the show. Just to start off, do you just want to tell us a bit about OwnCloud and what it is, what it's for?
Sure. OwnCloud is a free software project. It's about storing your own personal data and files in the cloud, as the name says,
yeah.
But not on a server, and at some company or some other country or whatever, but on your own system. So you're always in control about your data and your files, but you still have the benefits of cloud services, like you can sync it to your devices and you can share it with others and access it from the web interface, for example, or natively on your desktop or phone.
Cool. So we've noticed there's a lot of projects like this around at the moment. There's the one from Rackspace. There's Eucalyptus that's a bit like the Amazon product. What's different about OwnCloud from some of the other products out there?
Mm. Well, the main difference is that it's about having your files on your personal hardware under your control. There are a lot of services who try to copy the functionality of Dropbox or some Google services, for example, but a lot of them are host the stuff on a server which is not under your control.
Right.
So OwnCloud is, like the name says, having your stuff on your own machine under your own control. Another important aspect is that the idea of OwnCloud is that everybody should be able to host their own cloud instance. So we don't require a special daemon running on a server or special system administration skills. It's just PHP, and you need some shared web hosting space, put the PHP files on it, and it works.
Now, that sounds interesting in itself, that it's not some package that I need to have installed, although I do see that you have packages in the Ubuntu repository.
Yeah.
Now, I'm guessing that people listening to this will think that's interesting, and then as soon as you said PHP, and you're talking about storing files, and there'll be the security worries that people have. How do you deal with the security aspects of the product?
That's a very good question. A lot of people ask about this. The thing about PHP is it's the language is not very strict, so it's very easy to do a lot of bad coding with it.
Yeah,
but I mean, you don't have to. So we have really strict coding style guidelines, and we try to avoid all the common mistakes like SQL injection or cross-site scripting, stuff like that. And I mean, if you do it right, then PHP is absolutely safe.
Yeah. Right.
So I can run OwnCloud on a server even if I don't have root access to it.
That's the reason we use PHP. Because with other languages, if you do this in C++ or some other whatever web service languages, you always have to run your own daemon or your own whatever software as root usually. And that's fine if you're a system administrator and if you're a Linux guru, but for normal users, it's just not, I mean, not everybody can operate their own root server. And so we decided to use PHP because it runs on most web servers on the internet.
You were talking before about not needing to have, not needing to use a Google service or a Dropbox service where they provide the hardware and they manage it. But isn't that one of the big advantages of cloud services, that you don't have to worry about hardware, you don't have to worry about maintaining the underlying system and upgrading and replacing servers and things?
Sure, sure. The thing is that OwnCloud is free software, so you have the choice. I mean, there is already an internet service provider who offers OwnCloud services. And if you want to do this because you don't want to care about upgrading your software and stuff like that, you can do it. But if you care, it's also possible to run it on your own machine. So you have the choice. And in the future, we also plan to have appliances. So something like small plug computers, which you plug on your wall at home, and there's an OwnCloud instance on it. So it's really, really easy for everybody to run it.
Cool. So as far as features go, what does OwnCloud have at the moment, and what are the plans for the future? Is it just going to be like a replacement for Dropbox or Ubuntu One, or are you planning to have, is it going to do like Google Cloud applications or what?
Absolutely. A lot of people think that OwnCloud is just a copy of Dropbox, for example, but that's not the case. Mm. I mean, of course, we have the basic functionality like storing files and have a web interface and syncing and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But we also have OwnCloud applications,
right,
which are third-party extensions, something like syncing stuff for your PIM data.
Right.
Or RSS synchronization, or some games perhaps in the future. Mm-hmm. So all kinds of applications which can be installed in your own cloud.
So those would just be little sort of plugins written in PHP, or are there going to be other languages as well?
PHP and SQL if you want to use some kind of backend, or just HTML5, JavaScript, CSS
cool.
for the front end, yeah.
Is there any client side bit that needs to be installed? I could put this on my own virtual host or my own server or
yeah.
a box I have at home. Is there anything I need on my local machine to make all this work?
Yes, you have several choices. So first of all, you can of course use the web interface. Yeah, you obviously don't need software, just need a browser.
Right.
Or you can directly mount it via WebDAV. And then you also don't need software, because a WebDAV client, it's built into most modern operating systems like Ubuntu, for example. You can just use the Fuse system to mount it in your home directory, or use the KDE or GNOME abstraction layer to access it directly from inside the application.
So I would see that just as a mounted folder somewhere in my home directory or something.
Exactly. But you're also working on a syncing client, which enables offline use. So something like a Dropbox application, where you can run in the background and it syncs all your files to your local system. And this is, of course, a third-party application. Mm-hmm. And then you have to install it. But it's work in progress. We are doing this as this year's Google Summer of Code at the moment.
Oh, cool.
And we hope to have a working system in a few months.
Excellent. So how are the files stored? Is there any kind of encryption going on? Is there, sorry to beat on about the security side of things, but I know it plays on a lot of people's minds when they're storing their own files on a remote box. What kind of, is the data encrypted over the wire? Is it encrypted at the far end? How do you deal with that kind of stuff?
Well, of course, we support SSL for the encrypted connection to the server.
Uh-huh.
But also on the server, it's possible to encrypt your files with GPG. But there's, of course, a conceptual problem, but this is the case for all services like this. Because the problem is, where is the key?
Yeah.
So is the key on the server or is the key on the client? If the key is on the server together with data, that's probably not a good idea because then you don't have any additional security. Mm. And if the key is on the client, that's of course possible, but then you have a problem with accessing the files on a web interface or sharing the stuff with other people. So that's a problem which is not easy to solve, so we are working on this at the moment.
How do you, I can understand that's a difficult problem, and I don't envy you that. there is of course the problem that the someone or the authorities could walk into a data center, pull your server out of a rack, and have access to all your files. That's a worry. But I guess you could encrypt the data locally and have that synchronize up.
We plan to do this in the syncing client. So you encrypted the key locally and just sync the encrypted files to the server. This is an optional, so you can enable this for special files, which are very secure. But you can't access them on the browser anymore, of course, because you don't have the key there.
Right. So I had another question in my head and it's just disappeared. Oh, that was the other thing. just before Tony leaps in. What do you do about changes to files? Do you do binary diffs or do you upload the whole file every time at the moment?
At the moment, we upload all the complete file all the time. On the server side, we use Git for versioning. So every time you save a file, you automatically create a new version. And Git is using some kind of special storage for diffs, if it's at least for text files.
Right, yeah. That sounds cool, and that will help a lot. But I didn't realize it did version management as well. So would that mean I could go back to a previous version of my file?
Yep, exactly. Right. That's the idea.
How
it's not only a dumb file server, it's also... We want to provide some enhanced features like you said, versioning, so you can always go back to an old version. And the good thing is that the application, the front end, don't have to support it. Just save the file in a directory, and so for example, LibreOffice or something can just do it and don't need support for versioning. It's there automatically.
And if I had a server at home. And I want to set up an own cloud for my entire family. I have my files, and my wife has her files, and my children have whatever files they have. Do I need to set up a separate instance for each of us, or is there like a setup where I can have multi-users and all the data is stored separately?
No, we already have multi-user support.
Oh, cool.
So you have one administrator, and the administrator can create additional accounts for your family members or for your friends, for example, and everybody has their separate instance.
And
that's easy.
Is it one Git repository that all of the files are in, or is it?
No, you have several different repositories.
Okay, so there's no kind of deduplication going on. If I save a monster file and my wife saves the same file, it's going to be used twice. Right, okay.
This is, of course, a good idea for the future, but not
sure.
At the moment.
So I noticed on the website that the OwnCloud project itself is a KDE community project. Does that mean that there's going to be some sort of special integration with the KDE desktop, or does that just mean that the people who work on it also work on KDE?
Both. I mean, we have KDE integration into the KDE desktop, of course. Mm-hmm. So, for example, we can push notifications directly to the desktop. Sure. For example, if someone, if you share a file or directory with someone, and someone saves a file in your on your cloud, you get a directly notification on the desktop. There's a small pop-up there. You can see that something's going on. Mm-hmm. Or if you're running out of disk space, you get a notification and stuff like that. Sure. But this is just optional. I mean, you can perfectly do it without KDE. It's just sugar on top.
Cool.
But the thing is that KDE nowadays is more than just a desktop, so we have all kind of projects at the moment. We have, for example, Android software, or we have other web software inside KDE, so it's not unusual to do server-side cloud software in KDE.
Cool.
Cool. So where can people find out more if they would like to get involved or just to try the software out?
Sure. We have owncloud.org. That's the central website. It's at the moment it's just a wiki page, but in the future we plan to do a real web page with nice screenshots and demo videos and stuff like that. But on the wiki page we have links to the mailing list or the IC channel, and that's where you can get in contact with the developers. And yeah, we're always looking for new contributors, so it's a really young project, just a year old. But yeah, if you want to help, everybody's welcome.
Excellent.
Brilliant.
That's great.
Well, it sounds really cool.
Yeah.
Thank you very much indeed for talking to us this evening, and best of luck with the project.
Thank you.
Right, thanks very much,
cheers.
Frank.
Bye-bye. Bye.
And now it's time for some command line love.
Yay.
so excited.
I haven't had any of this for a while.
So this show's command line love is apt-clone, apt-clone, which is a command line utility, I believe, that allows you to...
You've read the man page, haven't you?
allows you to clone your current package state on one system and then recreate that state, I guess, the installed packages and configurations and things on another system.
Essentially, yes. So, people often ask how they can do this. So, if they, for example, if they're upgrading or if they're moving from one machine to another and they want to take their, you know, their favorite list of packages and they've forgotten what they installed and they just want to batch it all up and take it to another system, it's for that. Those two kind of reasons. But the reason I mentioned it and that it's really, really cool is that it can be used in an upgrade, and it does some rather funky things with packages.
Like?
So if you've got like 10.10 and you want to go to 11.04, or you've maybe got 9.04 and you want to go to 11.04, or some random old release and you want to go to 11.04, you put the 11.04 CD in, you do a clean install. But what it will do, or what it can do, is go and find packages that you've got on your system that you might want to keep, but for which the installer doesn't have a repository for. So it can't go and get that package from the Ubuntu repository. Say it's something like Skype or some other random third-party thing. What it will do is figure out all the files that make up that package and use a program called dpkg repack to put it all back into a deb file, do the installation, so you've then got a clean install, and then put those devs back on the system. So you've effectively got your system upgraded, but via a clean install, and then put the packages on top kind of way, which is what you would do anyway.
There was an old way of doing it using dpkg and get selections and set selections that people used to talk about years and years ago. Is it basically that, or does it do
no, you see, that has a problem. I've used that as well, and it's a bit flawed, because when you do the get selections, set selections thing, it doesn't respect or remember the state of how the packages were installed. So, for example, if I installed package A and that pulled in package B, and then I do a get selection, set selection, what I end up with is a manually installed package A and package B. It doesn't realize that B only came because I installed A. So if I ever remove A, it doesn't take B with it. Which means you're more likely to have cruft left around on your system.
You would rather defeat the object of reinstalling in the first
place. Exactly, exactly. So, yeah, app clone, quite cool.
Cool.
Excellent. We'll check that out then.
So that's our command line love.
It's time for the bit about Ubuntu, and in the first item this week, we're going to be talking about the exciting font news, that is the monospace variant of the Ubuntu font, having been released as a beta, for beta testing. You can get a hold of it by joining the Ubuntu Typeface Interest Group on
Launchpad.
I can't
wait.
Really?
Yes.
I'm using
it. Can wait. Okay.
Yeah, I think it's about... No, it's a little bit more interesting than licensing.
Some people are really itching to get this. In fact... Paul Sladen, who looks after that group and does font work for Canonical, pinged me and said, who have you told about this? Because suddenly he got a massive influx of people joining that group. And it wasn't me. It appeared on OMG Ubuntu and Web Update and a few other, you know, popular news outlets. So a lot of people found out about it and want to try it. So, yeah.
Cool. I've been waiting for it for ages. I use it on my in my IDE for when I'm writing code now.
Really? Yeah, use it as your font of choice.
As my font of choice.
Can you really see that much difference between that and whatever?
It's really noticeable. Whatever.
Yeah, compared to something like Korean U or Monospace or something
Deja
like that.
Deja Sans or whatever.
Is it legible?
It's very legible. The one letter I found I had a problem with initially was the I, because it's really squiggly. But then when you see it with the other fonts, it's okay.
Okay. And is it going to be the default in the next release?
I think they're hoping that it will, yes. But it's at the moment in a kind of beta, only for people in that group, and then it will be made more widely available. And once it gets lots more testing and all the glyphs for various languages are in, it could well be.
It's a special typeface for special people.
So work on packaging GNOME 3 with a classic GNOME panel interface for 11.10 is progressing.
Yes.
Yes.
Good news, I suppose, if you like GNOME 3 and you don't like Unity.
That's
or
the...
GNOME Shell.
Yeah, because a lot of people were, complaining that we ship the two options being Unity 3D and the traditional panel. And in 11.10, we're going to ship Unity 3D and Unity 2D. But people still want the option of going back to the panel, and they will be able to, just not on the CD, I guess.
So will this be a PPA or will this be in the main repository?
No, it's in the repository. Oh, properly, right. Properly full-on in the repository. Yeah, cool. That's good. Isn't it?
Yeah.
As of the 1st of June, Dapper Drake, Ubuntu's first long-term support release, is 5 years old and no longer supported on the server.
Doesn't seem like so long ago. It was new and fresh and just out.
Yes.
And installed with its...
Oh, everyone goes all glassy-eyed thinking about the little Drake.
It was the first long-term support release, isn't it? And that's 5 years ago. How far we've come.
So that's now properly no longer supported because the desktop went out...
2 years ago.
2 years ago, yeah.
Yeah. Mm. I wonder how many Dapper servers there are still out there.
Yeah, probably loads. In disaster news, a packaging issue caused cron to fail after a recent update, and apparently restarting the cron daemons is reported to fix the problem.
When I first read that, it felt a bit of like an anticlimax. It's like, oh my god, this thing is happening. You could just restart it.
But the problem is, if you don't know that it's...
Yeah, I know. Because it was unattended upgrades that installed it on a lot of people's servers, so you wouldn't have known until you noticed all of your cron jobs hadn't been running. Which can be a real issue.
I had that. And the first thing I noticed was when I have my podcatcher downloads things via cron. Yeah. And after a couple of days, I thought, well, I haven't had any podcasts downloaded for a while. I wonder if I should check out what was going on. But of course, because I'm running a local mirror, which in turn is updated itself via cron, I wasn't getting any updates because they released a newer version of the package which fixed this issue, which I didn't get because cron had broken the ability to update my mirror. So I had to do that manually.
They even went further than that and they blacklisted the packages and the broken ones in the repository.
Oh, wow.
So when you tried to update, if you're at that kind of point between them putting the broken packages out and putting new fixed ones out, you'd get a 403 error on the repositories.
Oh, wow.
So they don't do that very often, only when something's like properly broken.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people comparing it to the SSH security vulnerability.
Please. It's not like we ship CDs with loads of broken SSH.
That was in Prague we found that out, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was good fun.
Yeah.
Happy days.
UShareSoft and Canonical have announced the launch of a SUSE Studio-style platform to build virtual virtual appliances based on Ubuntu.
Yeah, the SUSE Studio is quite cool, really.
It gives you the ability to spin your own derivative of SUSE, isn't it? With your own packages that you want to have in it and its own configuration.
And it'll build an ISO image, and this is all in a web-based thing. You choose what you want in your distro. And it'll build an ISO image, a USB image, and a VMware image. And you can even boot it up in the cloud, so you can VNC into it without even downloading the image. I don't know whether the Ubuntu version from UShareSoft will do the same kind of thing, but it's quite cool.
Yeah, I'd like to...
custom image.
Yeah, I'd like to see that in action and find out just how flexible it is and what you can get out of it. And it's free, is it?
Pass.
Ah, okay.
Oh, I think it's free for Ubuntu community members. I'm not sure what qualifies you as a community member.
Right.
something. You probably have to join a particular group on Launchpad or something. This is just conjecture.
Yes. Okay, fair enough. And that's all in the bit about Ubuntu. So what's the not about Ubuntu?
Swiss National Councillor Kathy Ricklin has said that schools should use open source software to inspire curiosity and creativity in young people.
Yeah,
that's
quite an interesting perspective.
I think a national councillor is similar to an MP in this country, as far as I can tell.
Cool.
Yeah, it's not a terribly original idea, but it's good to see that thought being reiterated by people in sort of a certain level of authority.
It's not just about the money side of it for a start.
Well, when we were kids, back in the old days, it pretty much was open source. You know, you had programs that were, well, to some degree, you know, magazines, you had listings printed out and you typed them in.
Yeah.
You know.
And then they didn't work.
Yeah.
Many a game I've typed in like that and then it didn't work.
Yeah. And you, and I suppose you had all those little punch cards. I mean, they were essentially open source, weren't they? When you had to, and those big valves you had to change, Alan.
Sorry, I couldn't hear you. My hearing aid packed up for a moment.
Right. Well, there you go. That's all in the bit about and not about Ubuntu this time.
We've got some feedback for you, and we got an email from Philip Heckel, who we interviewed last episode about his Syncony project.
Almost 2 weeks after the interview, and a whole lot has changed. It really seems that your podcast and the blog post on Web Update really got the word out. I've had about 15,000 visitors to the website.
Wow.
Got tons of emails of people who want to help, and I even got some donations. Yay. We're moving very fast and are starting to build a real community around Syncony. So thank you so much for making all that possible.
Brilliant. Oh,
that's brilliant.
That was exactly why we interviewed him. So, yeah,
we
good
are
news.
The enablers.
Just yeah, nothing dangerous. To do with a really popular news site posting about it as well.
I think he shares the credit there quite
generously.
But yes, yeah, similarly, if you're involved in a project like that you want to get the word out about, and we're always happy to interview you if it's something that kind of fits with our remit. So get in touch, podcast@ubuntu-uk.org.
Or even if it doesn't fit with our remit, yeah, we'll have nothing anything. Else to do that week.
Catch us on a good day.
Mr. GF Tech, I might have pronounced that wrong, left us a comment on the blog asking...
Why do you, dear presenters, sound like you're talking through the telephone when you're interviewing somebody on the phone? I find it quite hard to keep focused if everyone's talking like that.
We don't put on a funny voice while we're all on the phone.
We're all talking to a tin can.
We all actually phone into the house from our mobile phones, yes.
Tony, explain.
The short answer is that we are actually on the phone.
That's true.
Yes, we are on the phone, which is why it sounds like we're on the phone. You may have noticed, hopefully, in the interview we had this evening, that it sounds a lot better. I spent some time last night fiddling with the settings on our little telephone interface unit that we have.
You pulled the string tighter.
I pulled the string tighter, and it does sound a lot better now in this other episode. So hopefully that's addressed your concerns. We appreciate the fact that it didn't always sound good, and hopefully we've now sorted that out.
Cool.
And Matt Mole followed up with...
I apologise if this has been discussed anywhere, but... Why don't you use Skype and then record the conversation?
Very good question.
Yes.
And the answer is...
Not free software. It's not
there
free
we software. Go. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Also?
Well, you know, we could. We could use Skype. Yep. But we originally, back in the first episode...
Do you remember those days?
Decided that we would try and use free software wherever we possibly could.
Yeah, and we still do all of the workflow around producing the show and the website and stuff is all free software. And if we've got a phone line, then that's good enough. We have had people dial into us using Skype, but just dialing into a phone line. So for us, it's all free software. It's just fair.
Yeah, we don't mind if they want to, you know, lose their freedom.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, that's fine.
And I've had very poor quality Skype conversations as well as good quality ones in the past. So it's a bit hit and miss. But yeah, that's what we try to do. We try to eat our own dog food and show that we can... do the thing with Ubuntu and on Ubuntu. And finally, we've had another voicemail from this fellow.
Wing Commander, Sir Arthur Curmudgeon here. After your last show, I received a message. What was it? I'm thinking of two words. Oh yes, electronic mail. That's how it arrived. I was asked what happened to that Vulcan bomber. Well, the Saudi royal family bought it from us while we were on a goodwill visit to Bahrain in the 1970s. The aeroplane wasn't actually for sale, but what with the oil crisis, we didn't like to cause offense back then. The prince did give us a fat briefcase full of cash and a lovely camel, so it all worked out rather well. Kept us fed back at the officer's mess for weeks. Very underrated dish, camel steaks. Now, what's this nonsense about the pronunciation of Oneric Ocelot? Some of your correspondents didn't even sound human enough to speak Latin. Did none of them have a proper education? Diligentia maximum etiam mediocris ingenii subsidium, as we used to say at my old school, usually just before a sound thrashing from the headmaster. Never did me any harm, as you can tell. I look forward to more Latin tutorials on your program. Yours, the WC.
What did he say in Latin?
I don't know. I hope it was clean.
Was it quid quid Latin dictum altum vidia?
Is that anything said sound in Latin? Is anything said in Latin sounds profound?
Yes.
I don't think he said that.
Oh, okay.
Phew. You just wanted to show off the fact that you knew that, didn't you?
No, I just thought I Googled it pretty quickly.
Right, okay.
I hope he does a talk at Odd Camp. That would be amazing.
Yes. Yeah, I hope the Wing Commander comes along. I'm expecting a big moustache.
And goggles.
And goggles. Yep.
And a flak jacket.
A comedy neck scarf that sticks out at 90 degrees the whole time.
Yes. Yes, we expect a costume from the 1980s.
Based on the 1920s. Right. That's all of your feedback this time.
That's all for this episode. Thank you for listening. You can find out how to get in touch with us on our website, podcast.ubuntu-uk.org, including voicemail numbers and Twitter feeds, Facebook and IRC channels. Let us know what you think of the show or give us your thoughts about Ubuntu and the community around it. Join us on Tuesday the 21st of June for our next live episode.
Now you're skiving this next one, aren't you, Mark?
I am.
Up to any good?
I'll try not to be.
Actually, we might be in Studio B next time, which might mean we might have video.
The return of the dishwasher.
Yes, I'll try and make other kitchen appliances make noises.
Yes, join us then. Bye-bye.
Bye.